Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening.
Good evening.
So, somebody asked me this morning, how do you write a talk? A really interesting question. I bought my little diary, and what I do is scribble down things as they come to me, and then go ahead and elaborate on that, and say, well, what is your process of, what is your intention? I was asked. I said, well, my intention has always been like that. This is going to be the last talk. I may be here tomorrow, I may not be here tomorrow, meaning I don't know how much time I have. So I do it from that, I write a talk from that point of view, that whenever I write a talk or I do something like this, I leave behind something that may help people, may not help people. It's like an art piece. Somebody gets inspired from it, other people don't. It's almost been a year since I gave my last talk. Last talk was on anger, and there was a background to it. So we're going to let that one go. So since it's gone, it's the past. And that's why it's called the past, because it's past. It's gone. So this talk now is called Fear and Lack. Most of my free time during the pandemic was taken up sitting zazen, reading books, magazines, and watching YouTube and browsing social media. On YouTube and social media, influencers would state implicitly, start a channel like me and you will be okay. And this during the pandemic. Looking deeper into setting up a channel, I found all influencer accounts were more monetarily and corporately funded and heavily scrutinized and controlled. Sitting in zazen with others via pandemic Zoom, a question arose in the mind. Beyond food, shelter, clothing, how much as human beings do we really need? Put simply, when is it enough? I came across a book called Richest Than. The author, Robert Frank, traveling all over the world, interviewed billionaires, asking them, how much do you need? To Robert Frank's surprise, every billionaire answered this question the same way, double of what I have. 2015, Lee and I were in Maui. I decided to go and attend a timeshare investment sales pitch and lunch. The sales rep took six of us aside and asked us, when you buy something, what are you buying? We all looked at him blankly. He answered his own question with one word, feeling. He then elaborated, when you are buying something, you are not buying a thing, you are buying a feeling. Later, I read Edward Bernays, the father of modern marketing, who was also Sigmund Freud's nephew, had picked up on his uncle's theory, if you poke at someone's insecurity, you can sell them anything. These feelings of constant chronic dissatisfaction or insecurity have taken over our lives, saying to us, you will be okay when you get that, or you'll be okay then, not now. We all want a promising shiny future. Yet on some deep level, we already know time is a persistent illusion, that time only exists in our mind. Fear of missing out, no mobile, ghost calls are now common lingo. And under these phrases is this unfulfilled feeling that keeps us constantly worried and distracted. Screens have become a substitute for support and friendships. Our technocratic lifestyle reads like written accounts of prisoners in solitary confinement and explorers isolated in remote regions, that they begin to feel disconnected from reality and a sense that their personalities are disintegrating. They become prone to elaborate hallucinations. What they miss most of all are eyes of others looking back at them. We formed our whole concept of ourselves in the first month as we looked at our mothers. Her return gaze gave us a sense that we existed. She told us who we were by how she looked at us. As adults, we experienced the same kind of nonverbal validation and a self of self through the eyes of others who look at us. In my earlier years of TV watching, episodic TV show Little House on the Prairie would come on once a week. The story was about a few families settling down in the Wild West. It would show horse-drawn carriages, horse-drawn buggies, farms, firewood was lit to keep the house warm, oil lamps for light, clothes for warmth. There was one phone, and it was usually in the general store. Mail was carried by a stagecoach. Family members looked at each other in the eye when talking. They took care of animals, worked on farms, carried wood. Later in the show, electricity, telegram, landlines, cards arrived in every household. People developed a personal relationship with their personal cars, a mechanical device, and left their workhorses behind. With domestic animals forgotten in the shows, in the characters' lives in the show, forgotten were the feelings of belonging, warmth, and caring for that animal who would love them back. This show ended with the erosion of community and a friendly feeling. Later on those cold, sleepless nights in San Francisco, in my 20s, I would watch Star Trek The Next Generation at night. A ship, spaceship, with a fleet of a few hundred people flying through space, as the captain's voice would say at the beginning of every episode, to boldly go where no one has gone before. Very similar to these space travelers were the caravan people on the Little House on the Prairie TV show, who had also gone boldly into the Wild West. Looking back, I noticed that the entire crew on the Star Trek spaceship would only use a communication device or the ship's computer to locate one another, and they would go and talk to the person eye to eye or face to face. At Tassajara, when you go to Tassajara, there are no cell phones. The cell phone connection doesn't show up over there. You cannot use your cell phone. So if you want to talk to someone, you have to go and find them. When we interact with people in person, our lives become simple, they become easy, they become fun. Last year, during this Sangha week at Tassajara, among other activities, I worked, talked, laughed, shared stories, and connected with other people with the other people who had been there from other sanghas and the residents. As the Hawaiians say, let's talk story. Coming back down from the mountain monastery to urban surroundings felt very artificial. Everyone in the Bay Area was rushed, fatally competitive, while comparing themselves to others, leaning on external words, mimic behaviors that had been passed on to them through media. I felt this manufactured view had affected our friendliness from each other, making it more conditional and divisive. Or as Zen master Mumon put it, 1183 to 1260, even more foolish is one who clings to words and phrases and thus tries to achieve understanding. It is like trying to strike the moon with a stick or scratching a shoe because there is an itchy spot on the foot. It has nothing to do with the truth. Giving up or running away from the hurtful, heavy world is a denial of the now, which is the cause of all of our unhappiness. We can easily recede to a monastery or become a hermit, but we will only be able to help a few folks. Not as human doings, but rather as human beings, our involved potential in life is much greater. Our involvement in this brutal and wonderful world brings up opening of our alive hearts and minds. Suzuki Roshi had once said, each of you is perfect the way that you are, and you could use a little improvement. When we practice Zazen repeatedly, if we allow, we see our fear-based conditioning of earlier years. Going deeper into the practice, the veil gets lifted from what we hold up as a fear-based ego map, or ego or personality map that we have created in our teenage years to distract, misdirect, and keep the world at a distance so nobody gets to see what we fear, who we think we really are. This fear includes the fear of embarrassment, the fear of loss, the fear of not being good enough, the fear of not having enough, not being cool enough. Once this awareness arises in Zazen, we come to realize there is no fixed personality, as our personality is just thoughts about ourselves. We can drop this personality and leave it behind. When we drop our personality, we can tap into the innate wisdom and deeper intelligence, which is our authentic self or true nature. Here we can see the possibility biased and not that old thought-generated limitation bias. When we let go of our little self or ego, the big self, the authentic self comes through. And because the authentic self or the big self has no fear or judgment, we can thrive and we can live our most inspired life as possible. Or as Suzuki Roshi put it, when we sit in cross-legged posture, we resume our fundamental activity of creation. There are perhaps three kinds of creation. The first is to be aware of ourselves after we finish Zazen. When we sit, we are nothing. We do not even realize what we are. We just sit. But when we stand up, we are there. That is the first step in creation. When you are there, everything else is there. Everything is created all at once. When we emerge from nothing, when everything emerges from nothing, we see it all as a fresh new creation. This is non-attachment. The second kind of creation is when you act or produce or prepare something like food or tea. The third kind is to create something within yourself, such as an education or culture or art or some system of our society. So there are three kinds of creation. But if you forget the first, the most important one, the other two will be like children who have lost their parents, and their creation will mean nothing. Thank you. But if you forget the first, the most important one, the other two will be like children who have lost their parents. Their creation will mean nothing. Meaning that if we don't sit Zazen and we don't begin from Zazen, anything that we do to move in our world will be like foundationless.
So at the beginning of your talk, you mentioned Edward Bernays, and I believe it was Bernays and one other person who came up with the concept of manufacturing consent, which was basically advertising. How do we sell cereal? And all this was applied to politics. You know, how do we sell this politician so people buy it? And that's where the title came from Noam Chomsky's book, Manufacturing Consent. And I think it's pretty relevant for the times we're living in, worth looking it up. Maybe I might reread it. It was Bernays and one other person, I don't recall.
I had to look it up too.
Yeah. But it's interesting. It's like we sell things based on words and ideas and concepts, but they're all based on symbols. And it's easy to manipulate people through their emotions and through symbols. And a lot of it's just empty. The meaning, it's like evaporates. There's no substance behind a lot of it. It's just empty symbols that we attach our hopes and concepts to that may or may not exist in reality. Well, that's all I had for you.
I think human beings have been creating symbols and concepts from the very beginning. You know, from the time of when we started drawing in caves, when the firelight was behind us, and the way to draw what we had from our memories, what we saw on the cave walls. And then we've been doing that for the longest amount of time. But the whole idea of scaring people and saying that, oh, without this, you're incomplete. I don't know.
The shadows on the wall.
Shadows on the wall, yeah. It's like, you know, people say that you have to go and find happiness. And I asked somebody one day, why do you have to go and find in happiness when it's already inside of you? You can become happy like that. You can turn off whatever you have like that and become happy. You know, it's the thinking that gets us in trouble. You know, when we sit zazen and we clear our mind and all the thoughts are gone, and there's no concept, no division. We just do whatever is in front of us. You know, and we forget that we were unhappy a minute ago.
I find it's hard to feel depressed when you're riding a bike.
It's hard to feel depressed when you're riding a bike.
Yeah,
yeah, because if you, yeah, you're absolutely correct about that. And just, you know, moving your body in itself is very good. And when we move our body, we do yoga or we do any exercise, you know, I was listening to somebody the other day, I forget who it was, but they said, somebody asked them a question about their past, and they said, is your past real? And they said, yeah. I said, go grab it and bring it to me. And they said, well, that's impossible. I said, there you go. So, you know, it doesn't exist, and it's gone. So I think when we operate from a point place that doesn't work for us, we really get ourselves in trouble. So coming and sitting and, you know, letting go of our thoughts, I think, whatever the thoughts are, you know, letting things arise, you know, I think it's very important.
Thank you for your talk, Umar. Thinking about what you were saying about the personal nature, even in like the Star Trek and the Little House on the Prairie where they're talking to each other, etc. What can we do about a society, a culture, media, and social media landscape that seems increasingly designed to steal our attention, our happiness, divide us, and make us into warring factions of zombies and demons, essentially?
Well, I think the first thing that we can do is turn it off. That's the first step. Number two is open a window. Number three is open a door and go outside. You know, go look at the birds, go look at the trees, go for a walk, you know, we have a brilliant trail over here right at shoreline. We can go for a walk, run into people, say hello to them. I'm surprised when I go for walks, sometimes I just smile at people and they smile back. We just don't know it, but we're all going through some kind of, some kind of residue that's left after COVID and after being shaken up by, you know, the ups and downs of everything that's been going on for the past 7 or 8 years, I think. So it's important to remember to come back to your breath. I think that's the most important thing. Keep on coming back to your breath and keep on realizing that you know, that this, whatever it is that is going on, you can just leave it aside for a little while. Sometimes, you know, just sitting and watching the clouds. I sit and watch the clouds sometimes when things get too much and I can't even sit zazen. You know, I sit and watch the clouds, and sometimes that just is enough to let the mind go and just see where the cloud is going. Yeah. Oh, it was in front of the tree, in front of the tree, and the tree that's in front of my house, now it's by the gutter, you know. Oh, okay, it's moving slow. So let's look at the movement and see how slow is it moving. Just watching that alone can be enough to let your mind go and let it settle down. And I think one of the things that has happened is also what you're talking about is the one of the reasons why we become so separated is we have lost the feeling of gratitude. We don't say thank you, you know. Just like we don't say thank you, we don't feel a sense of, this is a sense of enjoyment, it seems to be going away. Just like, oh, I just finished a book, let me go ahead and read another 600 pages. I've done that, you know. And after a little while, I'm like going, okay, what did I just read? And did I even, you know, really, did that even affect me? You know, so I'm just constantly looking for things that are simple or deeper, and say, oh, that speaks to me, something really simple. So I think gratitude is very important. I think we need to have more gratitude in our lives, even for the simplest things, even for like the water that we drink and the flowers that we see and the sounds that we hear, you know. And we go home from here back to our place in Newark, and planes are coming into land, you know, at SFO. And the way that they're coming in, it's like they look like stars hanging up in the sky, and they're getting lower and lower and lower. And I was thinking, this is just fascinating. This is amazing, you know, to see this kind of thing, and to be living in an area which is so lush and so green and so beautiful. We keep forgetting that, you know. We keep thinking about what we don't have or who said what to us, you know. So I think, yeah, enjoyment and gratitude are very, I think, is almost paramount. And somewhere I had read that the word enthusiasm, enthus means in God, you know, comes from in God, thus. So I was thinking, this is interesting that somehow in God got associated with happiness or joy, you know, being alive, being aware and alive, and, you know, open to what is available to you. And so it's all coming through us, you know. No, people say this is happening to me. No, you know, but it is coming through you, not to you, you know. So that's what it is. And I think one of the things that is also happening is that when we hold judgmental and critical thoughts about other people, we draw judgment and criticism towards us. on some level, after sitting for so long, I've started to understand and feel this. We're like magnets. We're drawing upon ourselves. You know, it's just like what we are feeling. It's just like when you start thinking of, you know, oh, a certain color, and you go on the road and you start seeing those cars pass by with the sort of that certain color, thinking, what's going on? Did I just do this? And so it's one of those things. I think enthusiasm, I mean, enjoyment, gratitude, and, you know, letting go of those critical and judgmental thoughts is very important. And getting out, you know. We can read all the Buddhism books that are back there in the library and, you know, beat it to death, but it's not going to get us to anywhere, you know. It's just, you know, be here. Be here. One of the most important things is whatever you're doing, be in that situation. Thank you.
I noticed that most people don't engage. You said look each other in the eye. That is very rare these days. You know, they'll text message. I mean, not looking in the eye, they don't even speak to each other anymore directly. It's always through a machine. And, you know, things happen in the world, and it is amazing that it seems to be happening all over, the same phenomena, whatever it is, that everyone's feeling alone and lonely and separated. I heard an author talking, he had written a book a while ago about clubs, and America used to have a lot more clubs that people joined, and he was bemoaning the fact that hardly anybody belongs to clubs anymore. And I don't know what kind of club he was referring to. He quoted de Tocqueville, and that's going back a while, about commenting on the number of clubs that Americans had. And I guess he was talking about the Masons and, you know, groups, larger groups like that, that men would join. But I hadn't thought of that. You know, our group here is a club, in effect. Mm-hmm. And when people show up, you get eye contact, you get to talk to somebody in real time, and thank you for your talk. It was not boring at all.
So the first part that Martha was saying was that she was talking about the teacups, how many teacups we had, and most of them were dirty. So we started the dishwasher and got the teacups going and got them clean. Yeah, it's interesting. Every time I've gone to Hawaii, the strangest thing that I saw in Hawaii was that people had cell phones, but they had the flip phones, and I was kind of surprised. And then the more I asked people, I said, "We don't carry smartphones. Number one, that they're very expensive." And the other strangest thing, the strangest device that I saw on Hawaii, on two islands that I visited, is that thing called a phone booth. They still have them. Outside supermarkets, you know. Lee saying that the remaining ones will be most probably are made into national monuments. Yeah, but it's and I never saw anybody looking down at their phone, or, you know, it was just people were just, locals were engaged. Yes.
My sister lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and it's an older population, granted. I talked to her about going into a restaurant and everyone is looking at their phone. She said, "Is that right? We don't do that here." So it could be because so many, there are so many young people in our area. It may not be true all over. As you say, in Hawaii, people are not addicted to it the way we are out here.
Yes, that is true. I saw a news segment the other day. It was really interesting. There is a documentary about these teenagers who have started a small club in Central Park. And they come together, they play, they bring their instruments, they bring paper, and they, some of them are playing instruments and they're teaching each other how to play instruments. Others are teaching each other how to draw and paint. And they have decided that they're not going to bring their cell phones. They leave their cell phones at home. They say, this is our time. We're here with each other. And these are 13, 14, and 15-year-olds. So the tide is turning again, where people want to be together now. And it is coming from younger people. So, you know, things change, you know, which is good. I was thinking this is wonderful that this is happening. You know, I have a tendency of, people calling me and the phone is usually sitting in the other room because I'm doing something else and I keep forgetting that the phone is there. So I don't have my phone with me and people leave me messages or text me and I answer them after 2 hours and I say, I'm sorry, the phone was somewhere else. And it's changed the way that I do things too.
I was really struck by your mention of the guy who went and questioned all of the billionaires about how much would be enough. And each of them said, well, twice what I have right now, right?
Double what I have.
Yeah. I remember hearing somebody once say, you know, what's the definition of having too much money? And he said, the answer is if you had 10 times less or 10 times more, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference in your everyday life. And I mean, I think there probably are a few strange motivations of billionaires. There was a project that I worked on years ago where I had a little bit of contact with Larry Ellison. And as far as I could tell, one of the main motivations for Larry Ellison was getting more money than Bill Gates. So maybe part of it is that they compete with each other. But over the years, I've really come to believe that what's really going on is not so much that they want to have a lot of money, they want to make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. They like the process of making money. It's sort of, you know, having wealth is the integral of income, and income is the first derivative of wealth, right? So what they're really enjoying is in the present moment, all that money is flowing in. And yeah, okay, over time they accumulate a lot of money, but you know, I mean, look, Elon Musk has 100,000 times as much money as I do. Is his life 100,000 times better? Could he really feel any different if it was only 1,000 times more money? So, I mean, I really think that it reminds me a little bit in a sort of perverse way of something that I heard Stephen Batchelor say years ago. He said, the way is not a path from where you used to be to where you want to be in the future. The way is just a path that tells you how to put one foot in front of the other right now. And it's possible, I think, also to live in the moment in a not very good way. Like, for example, I'm making a lot of money today, and I'm not necessarily thinking of that as a way to have twice as much money or 10 times as much money in the future, but I'm sure enjoying making all that money right now, right? So I think our practice helps us to live in the moment, but in a much better way than that.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to say to you, that even with billionaires, there is a lot of suffering there. Elon has a lot of money, but Elon lost his son during the pandemic. His young son was like, I think 13 or 14, died because of COVID. So, I heard an interview with him like 2 months or 3 months ago, and he was very shaken up by that to this day. I think the suffering is very democratic, you know, and it doesn't see, you know, the richness or the poorness of anybody. It just shows up. It seems to me that, you know, money and riches cannot save life sometimes. And coming down to a very human level, even seeing somebody as somebody completely out there, as Elon Musk do, that he also has suffering. He has suffered too. You know, so there is, so that's why I was saying that it is very important to see how we engage with each other. Life is, as I was saying, it's very brutal and it can be very wonderful. Yeah. So, and both those things can happen at the same time. Yeah.
So your talk made me feel very calm and present. It's hard to be real. It really is hard to be genuine. And thank you for reminding us of gratitude. As you described those planes flying over your house, how, I mean, that could be so grating, just the sound of it, right? And I have planes flying over my house too. And just with a slight little switch in your attitude and your thinking, the planes change from being annoying and noisy to being something really wonderful. And it takes so much practice and sitting, as you say, to change our attitudes or our ways of looking at things, right? That's what messes us up. And I forget it every single day, right? Thanks for reminding us of that. And gratitude. Gratitude is really key. Just being thankful for what you have. And acceptance, I think, of what is. Yeah. Thank you for that.
Thank you, Diane. There's this author by the name of Sean Stevenson. He is literally this high because he has brittle bone disease. So when he was born and when he came out of the womb, each and every bone in his body was broken. And what happened to him was, he has a great book called Get Off Your Butt. And he doesn't call it B-U-T-T, he calls it B-U-T. You know, get off your butt. I can do this, but, you know. I read it many years ago. He actually narrated the whole book too. I heard the audio book. And he talks about being 10 years old. No, 15, sorry. He was a teenager. And Halloween was going to happen. So he was on his wheelchair. His friend was going to come by, take him away to go and get candy. And he fell from his wheelchair and broke a bone. So his mother looked at him very calmly, picked him up, sat him down, and he was playing, he was dressed up like a mummy. He was already in bandages. So he said, she said to him, "Sean?" And he was like crying. He said, "Yes, Mom. Is this going to be a gift or is this going to be a curse?" You know? So he said, in that moment, I felt the pain, but I let go of the suffering. And she had taught him that if you want to feel sorry for yourself, she had given him an egg timer. She set it to 15 minutes, and she said, go nuts, feeling sorry for yourself, okay? And then you are done for that day. You cannot feel sorry for yourself. This is it. This is your allotted time, that 15 minutes. Go ahead. So he said, that's what I do. Even when he had written the book, he has a PhD. Worked with Bill Clinton in the White House. He's just this phenomenal person, you know. And sometimes when I read stories like this and I think to myself, it's so easy for us to give up. It is just so easy to give up, you know. And this is what our practice is about. It's not about giving up. And, you know, coming back, you know, and just keep on coming back to where the, how would you put it, where the fight is, you know. We're in the middle of the chaos and we're sitting. And I think that's what sometimes holds us together as a community, as a group, as a club, as Martha called it, you know. That's what holds us together. But it's interesting when you hear stories like that, you go, wow. And I was complaining about my life. What right do I have to complain about my life? So,
yeah. Was it the pain was it the pain he was supposed to let go of or the suffering?
No, the suffering.
The suffering.
He said, Mom said to him, you know, pain is, it's like the same thing that people say, pain is mandatory, but suffering is optional. So, as I used to say to some people when I used to work with them, I say, you're asking a question that's not on the exam. So that's the kind of thing that is there. But it's important, I think. So when you sometimes read things like that or stories and hear people who have gone through some difficult times say, oh, I thought I had it bad. Somebody else has it worse than I did. And so Martha is saying that sometimes we can't separate the suffering and the pain. And the mother was wise to let him know that to let go of the suffering and letting the pain persist. It is 9:00. So thank you everyone for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's KANNONDO.ORG.